I'm going to introduce Bruce, our moderator for this evening. Before he joined and was co-founder of Hastings, he also was the co-founder of Parthenon Capital. But before Parthenon Capital, Bruce was the CEO of Flow Control Equipment, which is an oil field and gas pipeline equipment manufacturing company in Houston, Texas. I'm doing some work with a $2.5 billion oil and gas exploration company on board issues, and so we're talking about Louisiana. You're going to be going to New Orleans tomorrow. So he's still in that business. Bruce holds a BSME with honors from Worcester Polytech, an MSIE from Purdue University, and an MBA from the University of Michigan. And I'm not going to talk about Hastings. I'm going to let Bruce talk about it.
Thank you, Larry. How does this work?
Okay. Just put that here. And put that there.
And I'm live, huh?
Yes, you do.
Well, good evening, I guess, everybody. Thanks for coming on this lovely day. When Larry asked me to speak, I wasn't quite sure what I was going to say, as usual the case. But he gave me some good advice, which was, you know, given the background of the folks here, I'd like to be relevant. And I can talk about a lot of things and say many things. I'm not sure how much of it will be all that relevant. But I did want to get a sense, maybe, what issues would you like me to talk about? I have some prepared remarks that I can go through just to give you an observation from somebody who's been in private equity for now, I guess, 12, 13 years. And I've been at the mid-market. I can talk about that experience. I've been at the lower market, which is where I spend my time now. But I certainly would like to, you know, get your thoughts on what you'd like to discuss and at least structure this talk around that so we can keep this more of a dialogue than me just standing here breathing hot air at the group. So put anybody on the spot. Is there anything, Joe, or anybody that you came with an expectation? Which, by the way, I did put together a little one-page outline, which I'll circulate here, just in case no one has anything they want to add.
Bruce, what are you looking for in investors or investment opportunities, and how has that changed in the last few years?
Okay. So let me just fix some notes here, and I'll come back to these. Tom?
I follow that.
Sure.
As in terms of criteria, whether that, and I might put it this way, that going forward, what would be different about the private equity model as compared to what seemed to be conventional up until about 2008, particularly with the large number and the fragmentation of the private equity industry, the pressures on the private equity world. I don't want to get into tax regulation, but kind of income tax pressures and potential consolidation of the industry, and frankly, whether that world that was so fat and happy for so many years can continue that way.
Okay, I think it's a very relevant point.
Do you see particular spaces or markets that some of the players are going after, and are the players kind of bifurcating? Some of the largest ones got into, they have public offers. And is that also a trend that we're going to see more of, and kind of, I guess the market's quite broad and expansive? And I'm not that familiar with it, so maybe you can say, okay,
sure,
it kind of compartmentalizes into two or three of these spaces, and we see this group going in this direction, and this group going in that direction. That would be helpful because I'd like to learn a little bit more about trends in private equity.
Okay, good.
Let me ask you, how much money is in the management now, private equity? What it was 2 years ago versus what it is now?
That one I may not have the stats, but I can talk to it anecdotally. In fact, there is a point I'll talk about that address that in part.
To what extent you were
sovereign wealth funds or foreign sources of capital are coming in your direction or in the industry's direction. From an investor's point of view, how do you compare the opportunities now in private equity versus venture capital?
Okay.
Bruce, if I'm looking for investment dollars, how would you compare and contrast talking to private equity versus VC options, for instance? I mean, what's the perspective looking at someone who'd want to approach you for funding?
Okay.
Not so much interested in what your specifically company you're looking at, but more of sort of the model that...
It's kind of an asset class question.
Right. Yeah.
All right. Well, go back to this. Well, let me just start, as Larry suggested, and tell you about Hastings. And I can weave in some of these questions, some of the answers there. But just to do my advertisement, since that's part of the deal, I get to come and give a captive audience my pitch. So Hastings Equity Partners, we're about an $85 million committed fund. So the market that I'm investing in is really kind of revenue-wise, sub-$30, $40 million companies. I like to see profitable businesses, probably at least $2 million plus of EBITDA. You know, we want to invest in businesses that have companies in situations that I like are many times an operator is looking to retire or has been running a business more for lifestyle and just isn't running the business at a level that they could be. They may not have the management team around them. They may not have the confidence to invest more capital. And so that's where I think we play very well, is to take businesses that are doing okay and make them a lot better. Our group of investors that we have, I think, is one of our real good resources and assets. And I can contrast this when I was at Parthenon Capital. We raised about $1.1 billion in about 4.5 years. First fund was a $350 million fund. Second fund was a $750 fund. Extremely successful. Our investors were State of Michigan, State of Oregon, General Motors Pension. I mean, Stanford University. It was a real blue chip. But I found as a guy having to do deals, my investors were good for writing a check, but they weren't worth anything else from a value add. In contrast with Hastings, we have a group of about 50 individuals, many of whom are current or former Fortune 1000 CEO types. And these are good guys. You know, we represent a very small fraction of their net worth. And it's a pleasure to be able to pick up the phone and call one of these guys who can network me into somebody, some situation, provide advice, provide me, they may be a board member, they may be relevant to a market we're looking at. And it's just a, you know, I liken it to the Verizon commercial. I've got this, you know, big network behind me. Then at Parthenon, where it's this big fund and a big firm, but, you know, we didn't have any of that. You know, we were always trying to find that. So it's from having been in the business at the, you know, the mid-market fund and the small market fund, it's an asset that we have that I can't say enough about that really helps me do my job a whole lot more effectively. So that's, I think, one thing that differentiates us. You know, I wrote in here we're value investors. You know, I've had my lesson in terms of paying up and using the balance sheet to, you know, get your on-paper return to work and live through a down cycle. And you do that enough times and you realize that people always think private equity is just, gee, you know, what a wonderful space and it's the, you know, road to riches. Well, it's the road to an early life when you're going through the restructurings and sitting with a knife fight with the bankers and deciding on $200 million of capital and what's going to get flushed and not. So we like to be low purchase price, low debt. A lot of the businesses we're going to invest in don't have the management capability, they don't have the financial strength always to handle a leveraged cash flow type environment. And so we don't want to overpay, we don't want to overstress, we don't want to take the balance sheet and get that, have that be the obstacle to us doing what we need to do. Which, you know, why I like the lower market, why I move from the mid-market is that there's more opportunities to invest like that. It's just, it's less efficient, but there's more value play. More companies that can't demand the premium, and, you know, the work I'm going to do is really the sweat equity that I should get the reward for. So that's our Hastings story. We're located right down the street from here, so it's great to stop by. We have a firm now of about 8 people, And I think one of the things that we've done at Hastings, which this will get to maybe one of the deal flow questions, is, you know, when we had Parthenon running, we ended up having bicoastal offices. I think we were up to about 50 people. We had a portfolio at one point, about 20 companies. But we operated much more like a law firm. And that is, each partner was really their own deal generation entity, closing, execution, sat on the boards. It was kind of a life cycle. And you learn very quickly that when you've got five or six companies that you're sitting on the board and really acting as the chief, you know, chairman running this deal, two are going bad, two are having replacements, there's just no time in your day to start getting on plans to look at new investments. And so that process broke down pretty badly. And it's, you know, you walk back and you say, well, if I'm going to do this again, which I've had the pleasure of restarting it, what would I do differently? And one of them is private equity is a process. There's different talents, and we all have strengths and weaknesses. And I know what mine are after 20 years of stumbling along. And you need to have people who are actively chasing deals and getting deals in. You need people who can process the deals and vet them. You need people who can close on them. You need people who can manage them. And those skill sets are very different across the board. And so what we've, I think, done so far, I'll say the jury's still out, but we've created more of a process environment and really put a lot of investment in the front-end resource, in the deal sourcing, where we have dedicated people full-time, and that's all they do, is just try to bring the deals in the house, both on a call brokers, call investment bankers, but also in a very proactive way, where we're starting to call companies directly and use our knowledge of certain markets that we want to be in and reaching out to the processing to the end. And I think it, so far, has provided a much better balance and let us leverage the skill set more effectively. And ironically, the skill set we have at Parthenon is very different than the skill set in some respects than we had at Parthenon. But Parthenon was a very pedigree, you know, if you didn't go to Harvard Business School, you know, you're probably going to get an interview. Where at Hastings, we could care less. It's really about capability and demonstrated performance and what we want people to do. You know, we have a guy who's in his mid-50s. He spent 25 years as a stockbroker. And his job was selling stocks. And we had him on the phone talking to brokers and calling owners. And he's got a gift, which is the ability to get you on a call in the middle of the day and talk to you, and you'll take his call, and you'll like that conversation. That's a skill set that I very rarely see, but boy, is it important in our business. Because at the end of the day, we're selling all the time. At Parthenon, we would never even think about hiring a guy like that. You know, did you come in top of your class at, you know, an Ivy League, and did you go to top business school? So, very different model that we're trying to pursue. And I think so far it's showing some signs of paying off. But like I said, given what we just went through last year, still a little bit untested. Let me talk, just I'll give you my observations what's going on in the PE market, and I'll try to weave in again some answers to these questions. And then as Larry titled this discussion, you know, what's the perspective for owners of companies and board members? And I'll try to revisit those. And if we, if I don't get to some of these points, we can go back around and ask the questions again. So what am I observing in the private equity market? Well, last year was just one shitty year. I don't know how else to say it. The stat that I'm starting to see in the anecdotal evidence is that the private equity is investment class. It's just completely in the tank. I've heard numbers as high as that two out of every three companies in portfolios are, if not in covenant default, maybe in payment default. So it sets up a very interesting dynamic that's going to play itself, I think, over the next 2 years with funds that are going to be never able to recover, going to have to go back to the market for money and won't be able to do it. And I think the short answer is going to be there's going to be a huge contraction in this industry. And it's going to, I think, play itself out in the different segments. But just to maybe address one question, is it Joe?
Robert.
Just maybe for your benefit, I had this conversation with Larry. Private equity, real quickly, if I have a continuum, on the left side is venture capital. On the right side are now the mega buyout funds, you know, guys like KKR and Texas Pacific Group. In that continuum, you go from, you know, first money in venture capital to growth capital to small market buyout, mid-market buyout, mega buyout. And you're seeing different things happen in that continuum. But I think one consistency right now is that returns are just anemic. In fact, I think from the vintage years of mid 2005, maybe 2006, 2007, certainly, you're seeing all the funds are underwater. Any mark-to-market shows it to be as low as 30, 40% below. And it's not clear, given that so much of that mark-to-market right now is in the terminal value, which is the paper game valuation, whether that's ever going to recover. So it does, you know, lend itself to a lot of questions as to how is this industry going to play itself out in the next couple of years. So just a couple of other things. Funds underwater, we talked about that. You know, the vintage year issue, I think, is going to be one that's going to still have time to play out just because there's been so few liquidity events for a lot of firms. I mean, typically, my experience has been a 3 to 4 year window. If you're in a deal after 4 years, it's a problem deal. You know, the adage when I was a partner was, you know, sell as quickly as possible. When we close that deal, our thought was, how do we get to the exit? What are we doing in the next 12 to 18 months to position the company to get out of it? Where, and I see with Hastings, and now that we're in small companies, you know, it's even more true, which is not that we want to be traders or flipping the businesses, but small companies with market concentration, customer concentration, you're just much more susceptible to that one blip. And that one blip can add 2-3 years onto your timeline from an IR standpoint. And so our goal is to always try to get a company up and running and see if we can get that first leg of value creation and not be greedy, but to, you know, transition the business to a new owner. So you've got a lot of the vintage years in the late 2000 where a lot of money got put to work at high multiples. And it's going to be, I think, just more pressure on the earnings or on the returns, where these high multiples, high debt, you know, that's not, there's not going to be a market there to get these deals cleared. And so, it, you know, which may be the buy side opportunity that comes to play and the down cycle. So we're patiently waiting to see if the problem market will translate into good deal flow, but I have yet to see it, which is a little bit of the irony in this industry. I'd expect to see a lot more, and Pat and I were talking about this, a lot more deal flow in that industry on the restructure, but it's not there right now. I think it has to do with some of the banks that, and the way they're managing it, which I'll talk about in a moment. Transaction pace. You know, our job is to invest capital. You know, the investors, and with the Parthenon, institutionally, you know, you get the call. How are you guys doing? When are you putting money to work? And, you know, that leads to a very potentially dangerous dynamic, because when the pressure is to invest, you invest. That's what your job is. But when you're investing, and I'd say the one lesson I've learned in my 15 years or so in this business is that you're always playing a cycle. And if you don't know where you're on that cycle, it's going to affect you. And the best deals down at the low end of the cycle, the worst deals down at the high end of the cycle. I mean, I don't care how smart you are or what your IQ is, it's just the fact of the way that the market's going to work. But in the private equity business, when you raise a fund, there's the pressure to deploy. And it leads to a lot of bad, poor judgments on the margin, where you start convincing yourself of the risk that you can manage through it, or you may be a little bit too Pollyannish about certain markets. And that's when you start getting in trouble and start pushing your leverage, pushing your balance sheet, thinking that if I need to get this IRR, I'm going to, you know, be able to get through this. And if I'm smart enough, we'll operate our way through it. And I think that's the danger of private equity and the danger that we've seen that's going to come due. The other issue we're running into that's causing, well, let me go back to transaction pace slow. The other issue that is interesting is somebody asked a question about the amount of capital invested in private equity. You know, there's a huge overhang right now because in the last 18 months, the deal flow has gone from, I think there was about 1,100 deals cleared at the peak in 07, total transaction volume. Last year, there was about 100. So that's about a 90% decline. You know, anecdotally, I've got some friends. I know Audex, which is a mid-market private equity firm. They're averaging probably about 2 to 2.5 deals, platform deals a month in the 07-08 timeframe. I mean, they just set the machine and were just processing closing deals. I think last year they might have done less than, you know, 3 or 4 deals, if that. And so you see that, and we've seen it. Well, I haven't done a platform deal in 18 months. And in part, it's because, you know, if you go back 1 year from now, I mean, we're just coming off the market low. The world was still falling apart. You couldn't sit down with an owner of a company and ask them to tell you what the business is going to do in the next 3 months and in the next 12 months. You know, banks weren't going to lend, and so it just caused the whole thing to come to a complete standstill. So all that's doing is building the overhang and putting a lot more pressure for funds to get money to work. The other problem is a lot of these funds, they're not focused outwardly, they're focused inwardly. They're dealing with this portfolio that is on the verge of bankruptcy. We've, in the last year, you know, have found that our portfolio, which in the fall of 08 was actually doing reasonably well, you know, we took the proverbial hit in a couple of companies. And we've had to refocus on all our energies at looking at the companies, going through restructurings, and just starting to manage for survival. It's forced us to do some things that were probably healthy anyways, but we spent a lot of time doing add-on acquisitions and getting the portfolio back to you know, an even keel. And I think a lot of the private equity firms have been doing the same thing. So the amount of money, I don't know what the dollar amount is, but it's still quite large. And, you know, it's going to be... interesting because, you know, a lot of these funds that were raised in 05, 06 are hitting a five-year capital call life. And so you've got this, you know, next moment that's going to come to pass, which is for most of you, when you raise a private equity fund, it's a 10-year fund life. 5 years you have the ability to call capital from your investors, and the next 5 years is to really return the capital. So if you don't invest in the first 5 years, you lose the right to call capital. And so when you have in this market where people are in year three and they have a year and a half, 2 year slowdown, you know, they're going to be in a tough situation on capital call. So that's another phenomenon that's going on in the market. What else is causing transactions not to happen? It's the same reason why I don't want to sell anything in my portfolio. You know, I don't like the market pricing. You know, a lot of good companies that have taken a hit, you know, people just want to sit on it and they want to try to wait for market recovery. I'd say the question was, you know, which industries have I seen the last year from a private equity standpoint that have actually performed well? And the short three are anything in healthcare practically, almost anything in education, and anything tied to military or government. I'd say just about everything else I've seen, and I'm not looking at restaurants, I'm not looking at food, I'm more industrial, business service oriented. You haven't seen a lot of markets that haven't just taken a hard hit. I've got a portfolio company that's tied to consumer product, it's a warehousing business, that's probably from the peak in 08, it's seen about a 15-20% decline. I have a business that makes cable TV modulators and head ends, which are used by hotels. So if you check into a hotel, your cable TV is run probably by a piece of equipment on premise. We're getting slaughtered in the hotel industry right now. Occupancy rates are down below 50%, and a couple of the large private equity companies like Blackstone that did highly levered deals, they're not spending money on any capital expenditures. They're all in default. And we're seeing that as a small supply to the industry right now. We're in an aircraft parts business. We've seen general aviation flight hours come down. So, you know, we're in these smaller businesses that have secular exposure. I'm in a natural gas platform service company, and natural gas prices have come down. So I think we've managed to pick a couple of winners here. all fundamentally good businesses, but they're with the tide. Tide is out. When the tide comes back, they'll do fine. But there's not a lot of good markets. And those markets that I mentioned, when you look at deal transactions, you know, they are pricing high. Educational deals are pricing, you know, we looked at a small HVAC training business in Arizona about 6 months ago. And we had a CEO that we're backing, he knew the company. We bid about a 5x cash flow. Somebody came in and took it at 8x, you know, for a $2 million business. It's just, you know, you're going to pay 8x, I'll let you take that deal. So we still see some pricing up in certain areas, but generally it's a pretty tough space. The other aspect to this that's been causing a problem is just the whole debt market. I don't know how many of you are dealing with the debt market regularly, but it's been a very tough market. You know, from my standpoint, we're mostly doing cash flow type deals. We aren't very asset-heavy businesses. And in that sub-5 million EBITDA market, there's not a lot of cash flow lenders. And those that were there have started to evaporate on me. So it's making our job a little bit tougher to put the financing together. But we're just seeing, I mean, it's actually not a bad time if you can put money to work to be in the debt side. You know, spreads on LIBOR are getting up to 600, 900 basis points for Term A loans. You know, the Mez guys are now, they're all trying to push their IRRs to where they want 20, 22% IRRs with warrants and PIK and current pay. You know, I'm looking at deals where if I can get a 20% IRR, I'm happy, and they're going to stand ahead of me in the capital structure. You know, that deal's not going to clear. So there's definitely a problem on the availability of debt, but also the leverage ratios. You know, again, I looked at some stats before coming here. If you go back and look at the 05, 06, 07, 08 buildup, the average debt multiples are riding about 4.5 of total debt to enterprise value. And I've just got to believe that average business right now is just in a really tough spot. The equity is underwater for sure. And, you know, whether you can even get back to the debt value is a question. What that means is that you have to pull up more equity in these deals. You know, most of the deals that I go to market with, I'm probably expecting to put at least 50 to 60% of my enterprise value into as equity. And if I'm only trying to buy it 4x, you know, 5x multiple on EBITDA for me is a high price, you know, you're not putting a lot of leverage. And so again, to make those returns work, you better really do something with that business or it's just going to be a, you know, a very kind of low returning asset class. So what is that going to do? As I said, I expect that, you know, we're in a macro market with, I think, some very strong headwinds. And I think everybody can have a point of view on what they think is going to happen. But when I talk to my investor group, and a lot of guys who have been money managers and been around many market cycles, and just ask their opinion, you know, where do you think this market's going to lead to? I get one consistent answer, which is hell if I know. You know, nobody has a clue. But I tell you, more often than not, it's a pessimistic answer. It's it's not going to get better. And whether it gets worse is really the question. Are we going to see a double dip, or are we just going to see this kind of go sideways? So it's hard to predict. But certainly it doesn't give me a warm feeling as I'm looking at new investments, trying to predict that if this market takes another recession, we're just putting money to work that we're just I'm on the treadmill but going nowhere. And even if the market goes sideways, the question is, can you really build value? All that, from an owner's standpoint, is going to put pressure down on pricing. You know, I meet with owners all the time. In fact, I'm going down to New Orleans tomorrow to meet with two business owners, and everybody wants more for their business. Entrepreneurs always think it's worth more than the market does. And I ask them, I think, what was your house value 2-3 years ago, and what's the value today, and why is your business any different? And it's a little bit more tangible. I think they kind of get it, but yet they'll still say, gee, if I don't have to sell, I'm making $2 million a year and life's good, so why do anything? And the market just kind of freezes up. And that's the challenge that I face, which is partly where, as we're trying to deploy capital, where the owner is making a decision on lifestyle more times than not, it's a tough decision. Unless they really want to retire, unless they, have a need, whether it be health or divorce or some other reason, their option is to basically sit and do nothing. And that just makes it tougher to get capital deployed. Some of the other points, questions asked here. The VC-PE asset class. I'm not close to the VC, but I got to believe they're not doing well. The venture model was predicated on getting the public exit and driving high returns. And, we can thank Sarbanes-Oxley and some of the other market trends that really put a damper on the public exit. I think the trend is where, I was talking about, a lot of VC guys have raised such large funds, they can't deploy it. And you're just seeing kind of the VC guys moving down that continuum to the right side, getting more heavier growth equity invested to maybe bio. And a lot of VC guys have built bio practices within their shops just to have the ability to be more of an asset manager than just be purely VC guys. So, as a private equity class, if you look at the mega buyout, the middle market and the lower market, the data is a little bit skewed right now. I think the mega market deals probably are still ahead. The mid-market, I think, is on average, and average and first quartile, there's a meaningful difference in all these returns. And I couldn't get my hands on top quartile, but the average returns right now, as I said, in the vintage years, if you mark to market, they're all below water. And so I've got to believe top quartile. I know back in 2001, we had an offsite meeting with the Parthenon, and we had Clint Harris from Grove Street Partners present to us, and Clint was working, I think CalPERS as a consultant and leading their investments. And he had, at that time, a look at all the private equity funds for about 70 funds in detail. And his conclusion on one was, and this is going back to the 98 time frame vintage, which would be a little bit analogous to the 2007, 2006. If you're a private equity firm and you did nothing but sit on your hands and collect your management fee, you'd be top decile sitting in 2001. So that would put you in 5 years 10% down. That would make you top decile. So I've got to believe today it's equal to that, if not worse, which is an interesting thought. You can raise the money and do nothing, which is, given the return, a lot of private equity firms are really working for nothing at this point. The other thing I think is going to affect this asset class is, there's a potential tax change in the capital and the carried interest. And it's unclear as to how that's going to play itself out in the market, where whether the asset class as a whole is going to start retracting from that, or whether the economics are going to have to change to provide the right incentive for the general partner, which is all going to come out of the LP's returns. So I think that's going to be a very interesting phenomenon to see how that plays. But I think at the end of the day, it's going to put pressure, downward pressure on returns for all the investors. Sovereign funds, I don't have a point of view on that. It's a part of the market I'm not that exposed to. I do know of a few sovereign funds, some Middle Eastern funds that came into the market back in kind of late 90s. Using basically U.S. Managers to manage the class. So I haven't seen a trend, but that's a part that I'm just not exposed to. And that's probably from a sovereign fund level. I think probably more at the hedge fund and the larger private equity mega funds. And I can only say that's not a place I've ever had any experience. So I'll have to...
Is there any Asian capital flows?
I went to a presentation about a year ago, the head of Carlyle, I can't remember his name.
David Rubenstein.
I listened to David Rubenstein, and he made a very interesting point, which is, you know, if you look globally and at the macro picture of private equity, it's really a U.S.-based business, but that model is now diversifying. And with a U.S. market that's, you know, going through a vast delevering and with a lower growth, you're seeing pools of capital now with higher growth markets in Asia. It really is going to be the driver probably of the world economy. And so, you know, his prediction is that you're going to see this diversification and the movement of the private equity leadership to offshore. And I thought it was well-reasoned and probably the trend that you're going to see more. And you've seen a lot of the big U.S. funds all moving to Asia. They moved to Europe in the late 90s, mid-90s. So I think it's going to be less them coming in here as it is much as, you know, money going to the markets where there's just a lot more growth opportunity. It would be my kind of, you know, general prediction. What else have I not addressed? Money under management changes to that. I guess this is really kind of maybe one of the themes of where the private equity industry is going to go to. And it's hard to predict other than it's going to have to contract. I just have a hard time imagining, given the amount of money that was raised in the mid-2000s and the peak of the market, that you're going to see anything like that in the near future. I can say from the institutional standpoint, I mean, they're looking at this as an asset class, and it's always going to be, on a ratio basis, a small fraction of their total money managed. I think there'll always be money flowing into it, but I think there's really going to be a shakeup between that top quartile sector and everybody below it. And which is interesting because at some point, top quartile, if there's nobody below you, can't be top quartile anymore. So I think there's going to be a big contraction at some point. And I think there's going to be a lot of guys in the private equity business that are going to be finding other things to do. Probably the consultants, CFOs, operating guys. It's going to be, I think, an interesting shakeout in the next 2-3 years. There's a lot of firms that I know are heading into the market right now. They're going to have a very difficult time refunding. And that may mean if they're a $600 million fund, they may only raise $250 million. So if they had a 30-40 person shop, you know, the partners will stay on. They'll shrink down to 15. You may have a lot of that going on. You may have a lot of guys who, at the partner level, have made their money. They said, you know, bullshit, I'm 55. I want to go spend time doing other things. And that next tier management, the firm, may not have the ability to raise that fund. So I think it's going to be a wait and see, but it's hard to expect anything other than a steep downturn.
Bruce, what are they saying if they're saying give us more money in relation to what you just said about the perspective about the difficulty of deploying the funds right now? It sounds like...
I'm giving you some very broad strokes, but I think funds that have been very sector focused are the ones that are going to continue to do okay. And if you look at private equity, I think generally, I don't have the data, but I think the bias has been back to that healthcare, business service, financial services. And I think if you look at, I'd be willing to place a bet, if you look at the top quartile performance, you're seeing most of those funds that's been their sector focus.
I think what the top quartile funds are saying is, it's great, we've kept our powder dry, and now we're going to see really good opportunities. But what they're doing is they're getting very aggressive. If you look inside the HCA deal, Hospital Corporation of America, which is about to maybe go public after they extracted a huge dividend, you'll see they're charging all kinds of different fees.
It's going private, public, private.
There's going to be a lot of money made on that deal.
Yeah.
If it gets out in a sense
of it. Well, look, the mega fund economics are just, astonishing. And the fees that are generated off these deals alone are just, for the relatively small population of professionals, it's almost egregious to some degree. it's not clear if that's sustainable, but, you know, if you're in that top decile of the mega, you know, they've got models that will sustain. There's no doubt about it. But I think they're the exception. And I think the mega really just has a whole different set of characteristics going on with it. Because it's really more of a financial investment firm from a standpoint of more of a, you know, I'll call investment banking-esque kind of investing versus the market I'm down is a much more of an operator-driven value add, working with management teams, trying to improve products, improve market positioning, things that are really driving value at that level. And it's just, you know, very, very different dynamics. Let me see any other points I've missed here. You know, I guess the question which, if not answered, is thinking about from an investor standpoint, you know, would you invest in private equity versus venture? And, you know, it's, I think it really all depends. My bias would be that you're going to probably right now do better off in the buyout still. I still think the venture with the capital markets in the shape they're in is a tough sell. But, you know, venture still, I just talked to a friend, I was on the phone at 10 past 4 with a friend, who, they've got a student loan business that they're about to take public. He's about to make 75 times to one his money. And it's about to clear, it's a good deal. So, you know, I told him that's a one and done. You don't have to do that once in your lifetime, you're going to do okay.
They kind of, markets, those two asset classes are kind of closing in. You wouldn't have heard in previous years a PE firm saying, you know what, we have some winners and losers. The answer was, we're going to make every one of these companies work. That's no longer the case. So we got some aren't going to make it,
yep.
But we're going to have some big returns,
yep.
on some that we are, that we've done very well managing. So
yep.
To some degree, in this environment, it's getting closer.
I think it's true to that. I mean, I can speak to my Parthenon brother, but our second fund, which was raised in 01, that fund's going to be a top quartile fund. But if you look at the individual companies, I think we had 14 investments, it's a barbell. We've got some atrocious losers in that fund, but we also have some spectacular winners.
Right.
With very little in between. And you're right, Alan. If you look at that, you'd say that looks like a venture capital fund, not a mid-market private equity fund. But, you know, the net returns are, after that whipsaw action, it's going to be actually not bad. It's a tough way to make a living, but... let's see. Let me talk about prospective owners and boards. I'm running short on time here, being long-winded. So what are some of the advice I have? And, you know, again, this is for many of you probably something you already do and realize, but too often when I meet with small companies, you know, the operator is an operator. They don't think about the business as an asset, as an investor. And it's, you know, I grew up as being an operator. I'm an engineer. I spent 5 years in a plant working as an engineer. I spent, you know, 7 years as a consultant. I ran a company, and, you know, my role was I'm going to operate that business and make that P&L look good. And it took me about 3-4 years as a private equity investor. It finally kind of dawned on me, I'm not an operator, I'm an investor. And it really changes the way you think about the business. And I see it all the time with the small businesses that, you know, it's to my advantage many times because they aren't operating like an investor. And so that's the arbitrage value that I have in terms of the business that's just not running the way it should be. And that manifests itself in just the things that they're not doing to really improve the value of the business, not driving it. I'd say that one of the most common issues I run into is that the owner will never have given any equity or any kind of performance bonus to any of the management team. And as a result, they have all these B players around the table. People who just, I mean, it's a self-selection process. If I'm in a company and I'm going to make 100 grand a year, and that's the Peter principle, if I can make 200, I'm not going to be at that company. And so, you know, our job is to go in and we'll bring in better management. We'll give them some sweat equity. We'll give them some real bonuses. We'll, you know, we'll just structure this. And, you know, we breathe energy into the business and it works. There's no reason why the owner can't do that. You know, we're doing their job for them half the time. But then the interesting thing is when we do the deal, and we'll always carve out a pool of equity to distribute to the senior people, the owner will always say, well, I'm glad you're doing that because, you know, these guys have worked really hard and they deserve that equity. Meanwhile, they're taking the $10, $15 million off the table and won't even give anybody a deal bonus. And you're just like, you know, greed is still alive and well in this low end of the market. But it's amazing little things that they could be doing differently that will drive value, and you know, it allows me to do a better job and make money. You know, management capability, you know, I just talked to it in part, but I would say the biggest challenge I have in all the deals I do is that there's just a dearth of good financial talent in these businesses. It's usually a woman who's been on the company for 15 years who's a bookkeeper, and she's usually competent. She can make sure the bills are being paid. She can, you know, stand collections, but there's just no one doing any kind of real thinking about the financial position of the company. And this gets back to the strategic side of the business and really understanding about where you're making money, where you're losing money, what are you doing in the operations from an efficiency standpoint, as opposed to the operator just kind of, you know, it's easy. They show up to work and they don't have to think. They can pull their $1 million, $2 million every year and, you know, play golf on Fridays and, you know, life's good. Which, you know, I'm jealous a little bit of that. Not to say that it's bad. It's just things that could be done very differently to drive the value of the business and position it better. The next point, which is probably the most relevant one I would have for any board member here, which is, you know, is there an exit plan in the company you're working with? Because ultimately, if you're not thinking about the exit, then you're really not thinking strategically about the business. And that exit plan may be a 10-year plan. It may be a 5-year plan. It may be, you know, I'm going to pass it to my kids. But there needs to be an explicit exit plan that you're managing to, because it just affects the way you start thinking about what you're doing in the business. And it's the proverbial right-to-left thinking. If I have an exit mind, it's really going to start making me think about and look at what should I be doing differently so that if I'm going to start selling the business, I'm not going to get the discount for my business based on things that I'm not doing properly, whether it's organizational capability, whether it's customer concentration issues, whether it's diversifying within my markets, my products. And there's a whole slew of things that you can just very logically go down that are all going to be key drivers of value. And if I'm not focused on it, it's just, you know, it's going to harm the value of my asset. And for a lot of these folks, you know, it's the biggest asset they have. And so not managing it is going to result in just lower net worth for them. But then the question is, you know, do you, in that exit plan, is it a sell 100%? You know, get the highest price, you know, hire Tom and Shield to do a great job for you and just go to the market and, you know, drive every nickel to the deal. Or is there a dividend play? You know, a lot of good companies can just go to the Mez guys, the mezzanine investors of the world, and do a dividend and not deal with a guy like me. The Mez guys want 15 to 20% IRR on their money. Take $10 million out, have a, you know, small play that you can pay down the cash flow and continue to do that in many ways and get liquidity and maybe keep that exit as something that's going to be much more on the horizon.
What's your target IRR overall?
I would say we like the 10th one at 30%. I can tell you every deal I've done on paper, I've always had 30% IRR when I priced it. And ask me how many times I've hit that, you know, either high or low. It's, you know, which is an interesting point. As smart as we think we are, it is almost impossible to predict when you go into investment what's going to happen in investment. Some of the deals that we thought were just going to be so-so deals turned out to be terrific, and some that we thought were going to be, you know, that's it, you know. And I say that from a Parthenon standpoint, where we did probably about 25 deals on my watch, from the Hastings standpoint. I know a lot of guys at Bain, and they tell you the same thing. They just, you know, it's very hard to predict when you go into, because you go into that deal thinking, I've got it structured, I've got a forecast, I have it priced the right way, and this is how it should play out, but it never plays out that way. So the other thing that we think about from board level is the two-step exit, you know, which I'll call a recap, and this is self-serving to me, but I actually think there's merit to it, which is get some liquidity today. Don't have to sell, take a discount, and bring a firm like ours who can put some money in and give you some equity, or give you some the sweat equity, and really be able to hump it, because we're not going to go into this deal and just sit back and do nothing. We're there to try to drive value. And so for owners, they get, you know, both diversification, liquidity, but they also get some professional help. And allowing us to be a sponsor, I can go recruit guys of your caliber in this table. I can do things that they can't do as an owner when somebody looks at the business and says, why would I join that? It's a dead-end job. And so we can change the dynamic, use the same set of assets, and start driving performance improvement. And, you know, if it works, the second bite of the apple can be as big as the first bite for a lot of these folks. And you've diversified. You haven't been exposed to the market and all the things that can happen. And it's happened very successfully. I've done a number of deals where that's worked out quite well. I've done some where it hasn't. But yet, where it hasn't, the owner diversified, and it was a good thing they did. They were actually the smart money. I had one deal. It was a short sale. We gave the owner the whole business right back. You know, we sold to him for 20, and he literally took the balance sheet off our hands and our liabilities 3 years later. He had $20 million left over, and he was the guy that could run the business. So, you know, there's a lot to be said about how to recap with a partner and think about that as an option, as opposed to just, you know, it's an all-or-nothing type deal. The other point, I guess, in today's market, you know, with the trends we talked about, there's a lot of downward pressure on pricing. You know, the business isn't worth as much as it used to be. You can't get the debt financing. You know, it's like the real estate market, very analogous. You know, you can't borrow as much money. It's going to put down pressure on prices. We don't want to take risk. We're trying to avoid balance sheet and leveraging up. You know, as I said, for me, 5x type valuations is my nose bleeding. I'm trying to get deals out of 4x, 3.5x, which is tough when you're an owner to think, that's all I'm going to get my business. Well, the answer is, in this market, that's all it's worth. So how do I, you know, bridge the gap between the bid-ask? There's always somebody's expectation is more than what I want to pay for it. And now we're going to get into all the contingent stuff. Seller notes, contingent payments on earnings. All the complexity starts getting into these deals, which I hate. But, you know, sometimes it's the only way to get a deal to clear. Joe?
If you find yourself competing for deals with other private equity firms?
You know, I would say yes. It's rare that we have a one-on-one conversation. What we do is avoid the auctions. You know, Tom does a good job at his business getting a market made. I don't want to be, you know, the nth guy looking at a book going into a deal where ultimately if it's a price-based decision, I'm just not going to waste my time.
But it feels like the finance stuff four times, finding how the private equity firms are looking for the same.
I think there's a lot of guys in that sub-30 million market like myself who are playing in that 4x, 5x, you know. It depends on where you are in your fund. You know, if I'm at the end of fund and I need to get some money deployed, I either don't employ it and lose the investment, or I pay 5.5x when the deal I get my $10 million invested. You run into a lot. That's the overhang problem.
I'll make a gratuitous comment back. You'll say that in that lower market there are a lot of smaller private equity firms. Some have better funds. Some just don't have funds. And the range of skill level that we see when we market a company in this market is quite remarkable to some people we would consider, and we know they're not really legitimate. And then there are others who have really who apply really sophisticated skills and do a really good job. I mean,
I mean, I think where we try to play and win the game is that, you know, it's called the beauty contest. And most of the deals we're doing are recapitalizations where we're going to buy 60-70%, have that owner stay in and help us through a transition so we don't lose a key man who has all knowledge of product, market, customers, and let us mitigate the risk of putting the leadership in. Where, you know, the pitch to him is, you've got a good stub piece, we're going to hump it, you're diversifying, but what's that stub piece going to be worth? And do a present value calculation. And who's ever going to help you get to that bigger number really is where your decision should lie. I mean, there's a number that we have to get to that, you know, we may not be the highest price, but we've got to clear the deal. We don't want to be overpaying at that point. And so it's the beauty contest. And so a lot of guys, I think it's what we can is Hastings, because I think we bring a lot of resource to the table, can, you know, out-hustle some of the guys, not all the guys. And in part of it, the self-selection, if I've got an owner who really is just driven for that absolute last dollar, you know, it just says to me a little bit about that guy as well. You know? And by the way, they're mostly guys. I've yet to...
Are you doing recap? Are you coming in as a preferred or private?
Well, we're always in a preferred structure. Yeah, my view is, you know, I want to mitigate my downside risk. So I'm always going to have at least a convert at a minimum. Sometimes it's a redeemable preferred with my warrants, depending on how punishing I want to be or how I want to structure the deal. But I've yet to do a deal, and I've probably done now 20-ish deals, and just do common. I always want to be the first money out if things are going bad. He got his money out first. I want to be the next money out if things are not going to recover. And that, I think that's pretty safe for most private equity investors. Like, few people are going to be putting money into common. In fact, I think it's rare if I've ever seen that. I mean, Tom, you could speak to that.
I agree.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, and there's a trade-off. My trade-off is always, I'm willing to pay a little bit higher price for a lower risk position in the capital structure. And I'll talk to owners about that. I mean, I'll give them choices on how I want to do the deal. And again, I will be willing to give up the upside if I have better downside protection. Capital preservation is very important to me.
If you're not owner management and the investment is value of the company is underwater. So in other words, your preferred position gets 100% more of the equity. How do you make sure the management's non-owner management's head is still in the game?
I've had situations where I've had to structure management's comp so that they're pari passu with me. And I've had two restructuring situations where I had to do that. I had to bring new management in And in order to give them the right incentive, we basically had to, which was, we had alphabet soup of preferred sitting in the deal. So it was very complicated, but I think we were down to like, you know, A, B, C, D, E. I think we got on F security. It was crazy. Yeah, believe me, this was bad. We ended up basically just having to cut them a deal so they were pari passu down that entire capital structure. And it worked. Those guys, we turned the company around. It was basically bankrupt when they came in. We sold it 2 years later for $80 million. Capital equity get recovered about 40 cents on the dollar, which was heroic given that it was negative. But those guys as a management team made about $4 million bucks in 2 years. It was a good payday for them. And it was basically two guys that took most of that. But they spread some wealth. They gave it to their top team. And that was because they took pari passu on that first tranche out. So I think we're hitting the end of the hour here, Larry. That's all I have to say. Anything else that I can sit here and say a lot? I'm not sure it's meaningful, but...
How did this job with your own experiences?
Is anybody here in private equity funds right now? You're an LP? And then what's your observation on how your funds are doing?
It's Bain.
You're in Bain. Well, Bain, I'll tell you, I just read Bain's...
That's a barbell, right?
That's going to be an interesting outcome.
You're in the latest fund or you're in the earlier fund?
For those of you who aren't steeped in the Bain capital, Bain has been probably, if not the best, one of the top tier private equity firms since its incarnation by Mitt Romney back in the early 80s. And they have a very rich set of economics. Traditional carried interest in private equity funds are 20%. So they're at 30%. And I'm going to watch closely to see if that holds for the next round of fundraising. I have a hard time believing it will. But who knows?
It might not.
Yeah, I would.
It's interesting because when Mitt started it, it was a venture capital fund. Staples being the big home run out of the first fund.
One of their big early deals was a what's the data information company down in Connecticut? Came out of down Broad Street. It competes with Forrester. Gartner, yeah. Gartner was one of their big first home run deals that they spun out of down Broad Street and put together a group to invest in it. And then they had another deal that was a big home run. It was buying a tire manufacturer. It came to the consulting side. That they literally, in like 2 years, just turned around the business, made like 30 times their money. So they had a traditional buy. I mean, they were just doing everything. But they certainly, it wasn't until mid-90s that I think Bain Capital made its first investment that exceeded $10 million. Mm-hmm. All those deals were done with incredibly high leverage, low equity, and the returns were just eye-popping.
They did a piece of Sensata for the last time I was there.
Yes, they sold very well.
Yeah.
I don't know, if they can
address
the Clear Channel, that
would
be a miracle.
Yeah. Well, they've got a lot of challenges on their hands. They've got a lot of retail portfolio.
Well, Dunkin' Donuts is doing well. I think as an investment, it's only doing okay.
Yeah.
Just out of curiosity, I know when Blackstone did this IPO, it did very well for the managing partner.
On paper.
On paper.
On paper, yeah.
Well, I'm not sure it did that well for those who invested. And now KKR is
more. Yep.
Given what you said about the industry, why would anybody invest in
KKR? Well, I mean, those guys, they've just turned into financial asset management companies. They have a range of products they're selling. I mean, they're not just, the buyout was the kernel of those businesses, but they're into so many different businesses that they're just a fee generation machine. And so you got to look at it really as an amalgamation of a different set of assets from, hedge fund to, debt to the traditional equities to, there's real estate. I mean, it's a multiple asset class model.
One of the, I think, big things about all private equity people, look on with admiration. They're very creative. I mean, Blackstone's getting the entertainment business now.
Yeah.
And there's a void there. They might just do very well.
Yeah, yeah.
But the funny thing is, and this is the point I think making. It's not really. People will talk about U.S. Steel, all right, as being back in the 50s and 60s, the bluest of blue chips. In 1900, it was a loaded buyout. So J.P. Morgan, who was the pioneer Blackstone at the time, bought Carnegie Steel and three other steel companies, rolled them together, and took it public a year later. That was you with Stewie. Okay? None of this is new.
It's just been institutionalized in a broader...
Right. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you, everybody.
Please feel free to stay and schmooze, and we look forward to seeing you next month.
Thank you.
I'll let you know when it's up.
All right. Thank you. Hopefully that worked.